You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Hello, everyone. Good evening and welcome. Thank you all so much for being here with us tonight. I'm Sarah Charlton, the Library Foundation's Membership Director, and I first want to give a big shout out to all of our members in the audience tonight. We so appreciate you. Thank you for supporting. Yeah. Thank you so much for supporting the library and programs just like this. The real reason that I'm here tonight is to invite you all to join us on Sunday, March 1st, for this Stay Home and Read a Book Ball. 100% of proceeds from this year's Stay Home and Read a Book Ball will go directly to the Los Angeles Public Library's Cybernauts program, which employs tech-savvy Angelenos at library branches across the city to provide patrons with one-on-one computer assistance, as well as lead small group technology trainings. This service is so valuable because it helps to bridge the digital divide and ensure that all Angelenos are able to fully participate in society. The Stay Home and Read a Book Ball is the Library Foundation's longest running fundraiser. We're celebrating 32 years now. And I'm so pleased to announce that we've raised over $85,000 as of today. Yeah. And Viet, who will be joining us on stage in a moment, some of you might know, was the chair of our Stay Home and Read a Book Ball in 2018. So we're always very grateful for that. So on March 1st, don't go out. Don't get dressed up. Don't fight traffic to get all the way across town. Instead, stay home, read a book, have a ball however you choose from the comfort of home, and make a donation to the library to support or for what you would have spent at a night on the town or a fancy gala event. You can pick up an official invitation right in the lobby, and you can also visit lfla.org/stayhome to support now. Thank you so much for being here again, and here's Jessica Strand to introduce the program. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Good evening, everybody. It's great to see you all here. I am the Director of Public Programs at the Library Foundation, and the Aloud series is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the LA Public Library. Aloud programs are made possible through member support, so thank you to the members in the audience. And if you're not a member, visit the membership table in the lobby or visit lfla.org to learn more and to learn more about the Stay Home and Read Ball. Before introducing tonight's program, I want to talk about home, the theme of this year's programming. In a loose way, all of our programs will touch on this theme. We're not trying to answer the question, what is home, but rather proposing ideas that hopefully will make each of us think more deeply about the concept and how it resonates with us. We'll be exploring some topics that seem on the surface to have nothing to do with the theme, but in some tangential way, there is a very clear connection. Other subjects will be more obvious. Here are a few things we'll be covering: our constitution, family, food, shelter, our mental health, and the natural world. In her novel, The Resistors, Gish Jen explores a dystopian world not too far from our own, where safety, community, and family are challenged by our rigid class system that has been created by our own human advancements and ingenuity. Gish Jen has published 8 books. The Resistors is her 5th novel. Her stories have appeared in numerous periodicals, including The Atlantic and The New Yorker. They've also been in the Best Short Stories 4 times, and including the Best Short Stories of the Century. She's been awarded a Lannan Literary Award for Fiction, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and a Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study Fellowship, as well as being nominated for the National Books Critic Circle Award. When asked by the New York Times, what moves you most in a work of literature, she responded with, "I am moved by many things, portrayals of the passage of time and of grief, especially these days. But my oldest soft spot has been for people guarding some small flame against considerable winds." Tonight, she will be in conversation with Viet Thanh Nguyen. The novel, The Sympathizer, is a New York Times bestseller and won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. His other books are Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam, and The Memory of War, which was a finalist for the National Book Award in Nonfiction and the National Book Critics Circle Award in General Nonfiction. Also, Race and Resistance, Literature and Politics in Asian America. He is a recipient of the Guggenheim Fellowship, and in 2017, the MacArthur Fellowship. He is an Errol Arnold Chair of English and a Professor of English, American Studies, and Ethnicity and Comparative Literature at the University of Southern California. In addition, he is a critic at large for the Los Angeles Times and a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. Please join me in welcoming Gish Jen and Viet Thanh Nguyen. Thank you.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you so much all for coming. I still have the habit of leaning into the mic, even though I think I don't need the mic. It's really, 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 truly a pleasure to be here, if nothing else because of your weather. Back home, it's back home, it's 30 degrees. So when I say I'm happy to be here, I'm really happy to be here. So as some of you know, this is my eighth book. And of course, over the course of my career, I've been asked many, many questions. So, you know, I've been asked, you know, like what happens to Mona Chang after she marries Seth Mandel. And, you know, I've been asked, you know, do you mind that we named our dog after Blondie and the Love Wife? And I've been asked, you know, like, how can you be Cambodian? I thought you were Jewish, right? But I've never gotten the kind of questions that I've gotten on this book, you know, which pretty much add up to, like, did something happen to you? And that's because this is, as some of you know, a post-automation surveillance state feminist baseball dystopia. So everyone's been asking me, so, you know, like, what happened to you, right? What happened? And, you know, I mean, there's many ways to answer that. But one way of answering is that, you know, I do have two children. And in 2017, my younger child did go off to school. And that meant that, you know, I had an empty nest for the first time. So like everybody else, I cried and I cried. And then suddenly it occurred to me that, you know, I had more free time than I'd had in 28 years. And it occurred to me, too, that, you know, I'd just gone through freshman orientation where we talked about, you know, the future, right? But also I had just said to my daughter like 900 times, I'd said to her, you know, have fun. Explore, take risks. And then, you know, I was sitting down to my desk and I thought, well, maybe I should have fun, explore, take risks, right? But there's something else also, of course, that as you know, as many parents will you experience this thing where, you know, your kids go off to school and you feel, you know, quite nervous. So, you know, I'm full of parental anxiety, you know, all the normal stuff like, will she get involved with the wrong guy, you know, blah, blah, blah. But also behind that also is also the citizens' worry. So, you know, so I have both. And I, you know, so I'm looking at my younger, you know, my younger child go off into this world. I'm very aware, all too aware, really, of what this world is. And of course, 2017, those of you who, you know, were paying any attention at all will remember that there was storm after storm after storm, right? So, you know, every storm was like the hurricane of the century, but we had like five of them, right? It was the year, of course, we were 10 months into the Trump presidency, and it was becoming clear that, you know, democracy itself was now on the line. You know, this is really, you know, things are really looking quite bleak. You know, on the more positive side, you know, we did just have the Women's March. You know, knitting does figure a lot in this book, and I'm sure that that would not be true were it not for all those pink hats. And also, of course, it was the year that Colin Kaepernick, or I guess Kaepernick, you know, took a knee, as you will remember. And I think that the whole idea that sports and sporting events might be a locus for resistance, I'm sure, was born in that moment. But in any case, as I was sitting down to my book, anyway, all those worries all came together in this book that is about a girl going off to college. I mean, it is kind of notable even to me that at that moment when I could have written anything, I'd just given myself permission to write anything. You know, I did not write about a girl's weekend in Paris, you know, involving devastatingly handsome men and designer drugs. Instead, I wrote a book, funny, about parents watching a girl grow up and then go off to college. This girl is nothing like mine. There are people in this audience who know my daughter, and they know that if this was my daughter, I would not be standing here now with my head attached to my body. And in fact, many people ask me about the baseball, and we can talk about their artistic reasons for the baseball, but there was a personal reason as well, and that reason was very simply that baseball is a sport that neither one of my children had ever had anything to do with. To the best of my knowledge, neither one of them has ever made a bat actually come in contact with the ball, and neither one of them can pitch or catch. So that meant it was kind of a safe thing that I can write about. That said, a lot of the emotional content, of course, does come from my experiences as a parent. So I'm going to read two short sections, and then I'll be talking with Viet. The first section is from the beginning of the book. This book is told by Grant, the father of the family. He's the narrator. He does have this very ferocious wife, Eleanor, who is a lawyer. And he has this daughter, Gwen, who turns out to be this pitching prodigy. There are two classes of people in this book. There are the netted, who have jobs, and then there are the surplus, who do not. And we can talk about, what it's like in this world. So this is a dystopia. It's set sometime in the future. I don't know, 40, 50 years from now. It's the indefinite future. It's close enough to our time that we will recognize many of our current trends. But it's far enough, hopefully, that, well, you'll see. So this is Grant. Gwen has just been born. And I will say I'm going to dedicate this reading to Simone, Viet's daughter, who is now 9 weeks old. As her parents, Ella and I should have known earlier. But Gwen was a preemie to begin with. That meant oxygen at first, and after that, special checkups. And her early months were bumpy. She had jaundice, she had roseola, she had colic, she had a heart murmur. Things that I can now see distracted us. Especially with the one chance policy, we were focused on our health to the exclusion of all else. For the netted, it was different, of course, but for us surplus, the limit was one pregnancy per couple, and Eleanor was just out of jail. Outside the house, she had a drone minder tracking her every move. The message was clear. She was not getting away with anything. And in any case, we loved Gwen and would never have wanted to replace her, worried though we were that she was delicate, that she might never consume the way she needed to, the way we all needed to. Not that charges of underconsumption couldn't be fought in the courts. This was auto America, after all. For all the changes wrought by AI and automation, now rolled up with the internet into the iBurrito we called Aunt Nettie, we did still have a constitution. And if anyone could defend what was left of our rights, it was our own fierce Eleanor, of whom even the platoons of Canadian geese who patrolled our neighborhood, the pit bulls, one might say, of the waddling world, were afraid. But as Eleanor's incarceration brought home, these battles had a price. And in the meanwhile, even worrying and weighing the options distracted us from realizing other things. Things we might have noticed a bit earlier had Gwen had a sibling. It is so hard for a new parent to imagine a child any different from the one he or she has. Children do so have their own gravity. They are their own normal. And so it is only now that we can see that there were signs. All children take what's in their crib and throw it, for example. It's universal. But Gwen threw her stuffed animals straight through her bedroom doorway. They shot out, never so much as grazing the doorframe, and they always hit the wall of the staircase across from her bedroom at a certain spot with the precise force they needed to bounce forward and drop clean down to the bottom of the stairwell. Was she maybe two when she did this? Not even, although she was already a southpaw. And already she seemed to have unusually long arms and long fingers, or so I remember remarking one day, not that Eleanor and I had so many babies on whom to base our comparison. Ours was just an impression. But it was a strong impression. Her fingers were long. I remember, too, having to round up a veritable menagerie on the landing before I could start up the stairs. The stuffed hippo, the stuffed tiger, the three or four stuffed dogs, the stuffed orca and toucan, platypus and turtle. I gathered them all into my arms like the storybook zookeeper of some peaceable kingdom. Of course, the house was automated, as all surplus houses were required to be by law. and the animals could easily have been clear-floated. All I had to do was say the word, and the house bots would emerge from their closets, their green appendages poised to help. Clear float now? Aren't those animals in your way? And we can roll in clear if you'd prefer. You have a choice. You always have a choice. The choice business being a new feature of the program, a bit of cyber ingratiation, you might say, to balance its more habitual cyber intimidation. If you trip, it will be your own fault, for example, and do note that your choice is on the record. Nothing is being hidden from you. Your choice is on the record. Meaning that I was losing living points every time. Living points being something like what we used to call brownie points when I was growing up, except that these were more critical than money. For everything from getting a loan to getting a plane ticket to getting Gwen into Net U one day, should we dream of doing that? A goal that people said involved tens of thousands or maybe even hundreds of thousands of points. But I picked the animals up myself anyway, as did Eleanor when it was she who came upon them, and all because we wanted to dump the animals into Gwen's crib ourselves and hear her quick cresting laughter as she immediately set about hurling them again. Everything was a game to her, a most wonderful, loving, endless game. Her spy eyes lit up with mischief. Her tea brown cheeks flushed the hot orange pink you see on the underside of clouds at sunset. Often she laughed so hard she fell as she threw, plopping down on her soft bottom, but grabbing the crib rail so hard as she scrambled back up that the whole crib shook. Was this the delicate newborn we had once so anxiously tended? Now breathtakingly robust, indestructible, it seemed, she wore an old-time soft yellow blanket sleeper with attached feet and bunny ears, a hand-knit, extra-warm version of a suit Eleanor remembered from her own childhood. None of this baby zone heating over Gwen's crib, in other words. She hardly seemed to need zone heat in any case, having learned so early to blow on her hands if they were cold and to cuddle with us if she needed to for warmth. Indeed, we were all given to cuddling, and we all wore sweaters, too, to avoid turning on the zone heat, for which we were constantly house-scolded. Don't you find it a bit chilly? Why not choose to turn on the zone heat? Don't you find it a bit chilly? But we ignored it. For this was how the auto house started, wasn't it? With thermostats that sent to Aunt Nettie first data, then videos. Then came drone deliverers and fridge stockers, kid trackers and robo-sitters, elder helpers and yard bots, all of which reported to Aunt Nettie as dutifully as any spy network, recording our steps, our pictures, our relationships, and back when we soon-to-be surplus still had them, our careers. And she, in turn, took what she knew and applied it, even proffering along the way solace and advice. Indeed, in the early days of automation, I myself brought up Ask Aunt Nettie more often than I care to recall, and can still remember her consoling voice as she volunteered, "I'm here," and insisted, "I want to hear everything," and reassured me, "Of course you feel that way, Grant. How could you not? You're only human." I did laugh at that, "you're only human." And then I'm just going to read one more part. This is from much later in the book. Gwen has grown up. She, sure enough, has become quite a pitcher. And in this section, she's preparing to play against the China-Russia team in the Olympics. In my book, you know, making baseball an Olympic sport was just artistic license. But it turns out that the baseball is actually going to be an Olympic sport this summer. In any case, they're looking at the China-Russian team, and they're terrified. The China-Russian team has been genetically improved, and among other things, that means that they are all switch hitters. Perhaps all this was fear, pure and simple, on the part of Gwen's teammates. But feeding their obsession, of course, was the sense that baseball was more than a sport, that it was a crown jewel. There were people who said it wasn't even invented in America. There were people who pointed out it was mentioned by Jane Austen long before it was ever mentioned here. But if baseball took on a hallowed meaning, it took on that meaning in our American dreams. For was this not the level playing field we envisioned? the field on which people could show what they were made of? And didn't we Americans believe above all that everyone should have a real chance at bat? Didn't we believe that with the good of the team at heart, something in us might just hit a ball off our shoe tops and send it sailing clear out of the park? If Gwenmate's teammates were playing Chine Russia for something, I thought, it was for this. For a chance to show, my mother would have said, that even if we all return to the dirt and the wind and the rain like the plants and the animals, we had a bigness in us, something beyond algorithms and beyond upgrades, something we were proud to call human, or so it seemed to me. And I'll stop there.
Well, it's so good to see you again. I think the last time we might have actually seen each other was at a very similar setup like this in Cambridge, and you were interviewing me in that case.
Whenever there are two chairs, and you know what I mean, one on one side and there's water in between, it's perfect. Our place.
Well, you know, it's actually really cool because my first encounter with you was way back in 1991, not you personally, but your book, Typical American, your first novel, when it came out. And I was probably a junior at the time in college at UC Berkeley. And
but I don't feel old.
Right. And I was so struck by the presence of Typical American. I mean, for those of you who don't know, 1991, if you're talking about this in the context of Asian American literature, which was my context, because I went to Berkeley in 1990, came from a very sort of white high school, stepped foot onto the campus, and was immediately radicalized as an Asian American. And I eventually went on to write a whole dissertation on Asian American literature. So by 1991, I was trying to read everybody I could find. And there weren't a lot of Chinese American or Asian American writers being published at that time. So to see a book come out by anybody with an Asian American and a Chinese American name was a huge deal. So I, on my very poor undergraduate income, bought the hardcover book, which I just showed you.
Which I just
backstage.
Signed.
Yeah.
And believe me, I know what it means to buy that hardcover book.
Yeah, and it's in perfect condition.
I'm really honored, I mean, truly.
So, but I was so struck by that, and I'm just wondering, I'm not sure if everybody knows your history, but I just want to talk a little bit about your career as a writer, and just a little bit, you know, about you as a person, because I've read some of the interviews featuring you. And it's very interesting, because one interview says, oh yes, Gish Jen dutifully went to Harvard, and then she really didn't know what to do with her life, so she went to Stanford Business School. And then she got kind of bored with that, and she thought she wanted to be a writer, so she went to Iowa Writers' Workshop, which is the best, you know, one of the most famous writing workshop in the country. So for someone who just didn't really know what she was doing, you did really, really well. And I'm fascinated by sort of this evolution of you from being this stereotypical, duty-bound Chinese-American daughter, Asian-American model minority to someone who becomes a writer, but ironically also goes to the best writing program in the country.
Well, at the time, you know, there were only three.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as though, you know, now there are a gazillion writing programs. But at the time, really, truly, there was only Stanford, Hopkins, and Iowa. And Iowa was the biggest, you know, so I just, you know, so and anyway, you know, and I didn't apply to Hopkins, so. Right.
But there was a cohort of young Asian American writers. This was like 1983 when you went, I believe, right?
Yeah, 81, 83.
81, 83. Were there some other Asian
only writers? A couple. I mean, there was just a handful. And I will say that, you know, it was a given that none of us would ever be published by a mainstream press.
What does that mean? How did you know it was a given? Like, who was saying this?
Because there was nobody, because there had only been Maxine Han Kingston and nobody else. So David Wong Louis was a year ahead of me, and Ben Huang was in my class, and, you know, kind of that was it.
It kind of blew me away to hear these names, you know, because I just gave a memorial to David Wong Louis at UCLA, who passed away. And when I did not realize that you were there around roughly the same time as he was. That's what I mean, that there was a cohort. Now we look back on that cohort and like, oh my God, it was David Wong Louis and Gish Jen. David Wong Louis' Pangs of Love was another book that I saw at the bookstore that I snapped up right away, right around this time as Typical American too. So, you know, you were there at a moment in sort of American literary history where, did you feel like you were a token at Iowa, or why did they take you if they didn't think?
No. I mean, I have to say that, you know, I mean, this whole, you know, now we're part of literary history. I mean, I was just a very confused young lady, you know? And so, you know, I always say that I became a writer by process of elimination. And that's true. I mean, it's a, you know, you could sort of say, well, I was just, you know, I was bored with business school. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, I'm the daughter of immigrants. You know, I discovered writing by accident, right? I discovered when I was an undergraduate. I was an undergraduate at Harvard. I was an English major. And I took this class in prosody by accident with Robert Fitzgerald, the translator. And he said that it was going to be a weekly exercise, but I didn't know it was going to be a weekly exercise in verse. Like, I thought he meant like a paper, you know? But I wanted to take this class because I thought I wanted to understand why poetry was written in those little lines. Like, why didn't they just say what they meant, right? And I thought, if I take this class, I will finally know. And that was true. But anyway, but I, you know, the first thing that happened is that, you know, he said, okay, so next week I want you to write something in Catullan Henniker syllables. I said, what? But I sat down to write this poem, and, you know, like right away I loved it. And I actually said to my roommate, I said, oh my God, I love this. And if I could, I would do this for the rest of my life. But I'm the daughter of immigrants. It never crossed my mind that you could actually become a writer. It just never really, you know, it just never crossed my mind. But anyway, I went on and I wrote poem after poem. And Fitzgerald was very encouraging. And he basically, at the time I was pre-med, and he said, why are you pre-med? And I said, that was a very cool question, especially since I've just gotten a C in calculus. And I said, you know, I don't know why I'm pre-med. And he said, you should do something with words. He really wanted me to be a poet. But he said, if you're not going to be a poet, you should at least go into publishing. And he did get me my first job. And my first job, you know, there I was. But I felt that I had ended up in between these two worlds, where I was neither doing what I really wanted to do, but I wasn't going to be able to make a living either, you know? And then I thought, I just thought, well, if I can't decide which one to do, why don't I try the practical one first, you know? And I have to say, I had also thought about law school as an undergrad. So I'd already been pre-med and pre-law. That left business school the one thing I had never thought about. But I applied. You know, one thing about I'm sure you found this, you know, you can write your way into anything. I mean, I was like the least prepared person in the business school class. I mean, I really mean that. There I am. But, you know, as soon as I got there, I knew I was in the wrong place. And I will say that I did get into Stanford, Harvard. I went to Stanford because I knew they had a writing program. So I was very, very confused. And I did drop out, like not because, first of all, I hadn't gone to any classes. So it wasn't so hard to drop out, you know. But I dropped out and then I went to Iowa, and like I say, there were only a couple of programs. It wasn't like, you know. So I took a year in China in between.
Right. So I remember also I as an undergraduate, you know, one of my professors assigned write a sonnet, for example. I thought that was fun. I wrote a sonnet, you know, and then I wrote some more poetry, and then I realized I'm a terrible poet. So then I decided to write fiction instead. So what was that transition for you? How did you decide that poetry was not your thing? You were going to write fiction instead, and then a novel specifically.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because, you know, the fact of the matter is that my poetry was very narrative. So it wasn't like, and that would have been fine. But it was noticeable that, you know, I was not so much, if you have a continuum between lyric and narrative, you know, I was over here as a poet. So that part of it seemed very natural. And then what happened was that I was, you know, when I was in publishing, Doubleday would pay for you to take courses, you know, any courses you wanted to. And so I was taking courses at the New School while I was at Doubleday. And also, I will say that I was surrounded by people who were interested in fiction. So that, you know, the editorial assistant at the next desk was really interested. You know, so every, you know, the New Yorker would come, we would like discuss, we never did any work. But, you know, the New Yorker would come, we would like discuss the stories immediately. And I had a boyfriend then, he was also interested in writing. Actually, John Wiener went on to get a Pulitzer Prize in nonfiction. And so, you know, it was just, you know, when I was in New York, it was just fiction, 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 fiction. And that's why when I applied to business school, I decided to go to Stanford. And I will say I spent that first year in business school, I read 100 novels and took all the fiction writing classes that, you know, I could take across the street. So I wasn't really exactly in the business school program, I think it's fair to say. Yeah.
100 books seems like the magic number. I think I remember Junot Diaz saying that he taught himself how to write partly by reading 100 short story collections before he worked around.
Yeah, 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 you know,
example.
So something about that. Yeah. Anyway, I remember 100 books, you know, but I read a lot of novels when I was supposed to be
so then you wrote Mona and the Promised Land, your first book, right?
No. Typical American.
Oh, I'm sorry. Typical American, then Mona and the Promised Land. But both of them are comic novels, which is also very striking to me because they're, you know, it's a very particular form. Not everybody can write comic novels. Mm. You know, tell a joke, find comic situations. Was that natural for you to do that, to slip into that mode, or was it a very deliberate choice for you to do that versus writing the stereotypical first, very serious novel, especially if you're classified as Chinese American or Asian American or an immigrant descendant?
You know, I'm just funny.
Okay, that's it.
I mean,
some people don't.
My husband is here to tell you that. I mean, I will tell funny stories in my sleep.
Right.
And I will wake myself up laughing.
Right.
So it's just genetic, I have to say. My father had a tremendous sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And I notice also now I have a son with a tremendous sense of humor. And so I personally think it's just genetic.
Okay.
Yeah. I, you know.
Well, Your life story is kind of funny in a way. Okay.
It didn't feel so funny at the time.
Well, I was gonna say your mother really objected to you becoming a writer, and you guys didn't talk for quite a bit of time. Was that your most difficult moment as a writer, or was there some other moment? I'm interested in the worst moments that writers have.
That was a terrible moment. So when I dropped out of Stanford Business School, you know, I will say that, you know, all hell broke loose at home. I mean, I think that, so what you can sort of see is that basically I've been kind of keeping the cover of doing the right thing while underneath it I was doing something, you know, completely different. And that had been true. That was true when I was in grade school as well. You know what I mean? So I was the A student who was always in the hall, you know, kind of kicked out of class mostly for talking. And you know, so, but it was, I'd always managed to kind of, like I say, kind of, you know, kind of still have this veneer of duty or something. But when I dropped out of Stanford Business School, my parents had a cow. And they were absolutely against my becoming a writer. I mean, which I understand today. I mean, you know, my parents, you know, they had a very difficult time. I mean, they were immigrants. You know, they had come at a time when really, truly being an immigrant, a Chinese immigrant, I mean, there were like 200 of them immigrated the year they did. I mean, it was like they were a very tiny minority. Things had been very, very rough for them. They were, you know, they were unwilling immigrants. I mean, they had not intended to stay in the United States at all. And here they were stuck in this place. And anyway, after my father was not a citizen until I was like in third grade. And so, and they had five kids. So, you know, by the time the kids are finally in school, they just want to see a little security. And it's very hard to see a kid go off and become a writer.
Well, another funny part of your family history, I think it's somewhere in the interview, it mentions, oh, four out of the five kids went to Ivy League universities. And I thought, isn't that enough? Aren't immigrant parents satisfied enough? But they need everybody.
I know.
Well,
you had 100%, right?
No, my brother went to Harvard, as a matter of fact, not long after you did.
Well, that was back in the days when everybody went to Harvard.
Right. Anybody who's a refugee could get into Harvard, you know. But by my time, it was too late. Everybody had seen too many refugees. But I find it very courageous when people become writers, like explicitly when they go around saying, "Hi, I'm a writer." And in my case, I was hit because I was always, I mean, I did not go to a writing program. I went to get my PhD in English, which was hard enough for my parents to understand.
Yeah.
You know, I'm getting a doctorate. They said, yeah, in English. No, they were not quite so happy about that. But at least I was getting a doctorate of some kind, you know. But you went, there was no way for you to hide. You were going to go to get the MFA at Iowa. And did you become a full-time writer after that, or
you know, I had like everybody else, I had a gazillion other gigs. Right. You know, I worked in an auction house. I mean, I had many gigs. It wasn't full time, but you know, but you're right. But the funny thing is, again, you know, I have to say that even though, you know, I'm sort of doing all the writerly things, you know, including changing my name, right? And, you know, I mean, there are many, many, many signs that I was kind of this rebellious person underneath this.
Your name was Lillian, right?
Yeah.
And you became Gish Lillian.
That's another long story.
But it's a funny little bit of cinematic history involved in there.
Yeah, but that's a long story. But anyway, right. But the point is that, so I'm going along a little. But actually, I did not actually call myself a writer until I was at the Bunting Institute. Mm-hmm. I had gotten a Bunting really by accident. I don't know what made me apply. And you know, this was what, 1986. I guess I applied in 1985. And I still remember, you know, they had written to me to sort of say, you know, only one of your recommendations came in, and I had done exactly nothing. I was like, no, I'm not going to get a Bunting Institute, you know, a fellowship at the Bunting Institute. This is what's now a Radcliffe fellowship. And And I happened to go out to lunch with a friend of mine who asked, she said, didn't you apply for a bunting? I said, yeah. And she said, well, you know, what happened? And I said, well, you know, they wrote to me and they said, you know, one of my recommendations didn't come in. And she said, well, what'd you do? I said, well, I did nothing. And she said, what do you mean you did nothing? I said, I'm not going to get a bunting. And she walked up, that was Martha Collins, the poet. She walked up to Radcliffe Quad and said, I am Gish Jan's second recommender. Mm-hmm. And then in the fall, there I was. Mm-hmm. But at that point, though, I mean, I tell you, I mean, this was so improbable. I had thought, there's just no way this is all going to happen, right? In fact, I'm thinking that I might get a job, like some kind of secretarial job or something at Harvard. I had taken the typing test. Mm-hmm. And I can still remember, because we're writers, we actually type really well. But I can still remember the moment where the person at the front said, Lillian Jen? And I thought, oh, that's me. And she said, you've typed 93 words a minute with no mistakes. I'm sure we can find you a job. Hmm. And I was just like, oh, this is the best thing that happened to me in quite a time. But then they didn't find me a job. And, you know, so I'm like waiting. Anyway, by the time they finally called, it was the fall. And they called me and said, you know, we've got you this job in such and such an office. And I said, I am sorry. I am no longer interested. I am now a fellow at the Bunting Institute. Mm. Bang. But I always felt, you know, I think my life is full of these kind of moments of serendipity. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember the scene in The African Queen, mm-hmm. where, you know, Katharine Hepburn is like covered with leeches and it's been raining and raining and they're lost in the jungle, you know, and it's just hopeless and they go to sleep in despair. And then it rains and rains and rains so much that they get floated out into the open mm-hmm. ocean and they wake up and they're like, I'm in the middle of this river and all is saved. I've had so many moments like that. And I really mean it. Anyway, and this experience at the Radcliffe Institute was very much like that.
So then out of that comes Typical American. And you did an interview with Maxine Hong Kingston, who was one of my teachers as well at Berkeley. And, you know, she described your work, I'm not sure which novel she was talking about, or set of novels, but as great American novels, okay? And this is a segue into The Resisters, because The Resisters seems to me, like a great American novel in the sense that it takes as its subject a couple of different, I mean, America is the subject.
Yes.
But also baseball. And I come to this novel as someone who hardly ever watches baseball and is aware of it right now only because of the current scandal in Major League Baseball about the World Series. It's particularly painful for LA people, right? The Dodgers lost. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, right? The Dodgers lost to the Astros in the World Series, and now the Astros, you know, have basically been proven to have cheated their way through quite a few games.
You got to love it, that the way they cheat is by banging on a trash can.
Yeah, I don't get it.
How can no one have noticed?
Right, no one noticed. Bang. And it's a trash can of all the kinds of symbols that you can pick. So here you have America's great pastime being completely corrupted in a very divisive political age that seems to be marked by corruption. Mm. So is that one reason why you chose baseball?
No. I mean, I will say that, you know, my book is a dystopia, but it's kind of utopia as well, right? And the actual baseball as it exists in my book mm-hmm. is, you know, this is the dream baseball, you know? And in fact, the baseball in my book is more egalitarian than baseball as is practiced, right?
It's sort of amateur baseball that's being described.
Well, it's really like Little League, yeah. But then up, because they do end up at the Olympics. Mm-hmm. But this is a baseball, you know, it's funny, of course, I read every single biography and autobiography of a woman pitcher, mm-hmm. you know, it's ever been written. And, you know, in my book, you know, I mean, this is like biographies by people like Mimi Peanut Johnson, who I love. I love her partly because she was 5'3", 105 pounds in her uniform, sopping wet. And was taught to pitch by Satchel Paige, and played in the Negro Leagues, you know, and you know she was really something. And you know, in my novel, she would have gotten to pitch, you know what I mean? And so this is a way in which even you know, so it's definitely a critique of America, even in its utopianness as well in its dystopian aspects. But baseball is the great American sport. I mean, I think that you know my interest in it, and you probably can appreciate this, that you know it is the way in which many immigrants first perform Americanness. Mm. You know, they go to a baseball game, they have a hot dog, mm. they figure out which team is which, And it's, you know, and it, but of course it's, and they learn a lot of things about democracy while they're out there. I mean, you know, the whole idea that you can have an individual, but the individual, there's a balance between the individual and the collective that's maybe a little different than what they had when they were home. Mm-hmm. The whole idea that, that, you know, that you can have a space that's governed by laws to which people consent that finally work to help everybody you know, realize something in themselves. I mean, that's a big American idea. Mm-hmm. And of course, the level playing field and the idea that everybody gets a chance at that. I mean, there's a lot about baseball and also about the rules, by the way, knowing the rules, you know, it's like understanding the legal system, right? You know, it's there and there are all these, you know, little funny things about it, which you can master. And I will say that I have kind of an emotional attachment to this. I mean, the reason, you know, baseball, I myself am not a baseball fan, but I will say that, you know, that this business of what baseball comes to mean to immigrants, that is, I actually know that firsthand. Because my mother, who is like the least athletic person ever, and there's a family member here who can tell you that that is true, is also the biggest baseball fanatic ever, you know, and that's part of her Americanization. And I mean, this is so true that that actually she was, she's in her 90s. She's very, very sick 2 summers ago. And so she was in septic shock. We did think that she was going to die. And so, you know, we're all racing down to her sick bed, and she, you know, priest has been called in for last rites. She's non-responsive. But my brother, trying to get her to respond, like, what does he do? He leans over her, and then he says, Mom, he says, the Yankees are in a slump. The Red Sox are eating their lunch. And my mother opens her eyes. Bat, bat, bat. And she says, that Aaron Boone should be fired. Aaron Boone is manager of the Yankees. I mean, when I say that we were fanatics. I mean, I understand this kind of firsthand. And I will say, too, that, you know, people have asked me a lot about the pitching. My brother, it turned out, had an incredible arm. You know, and this is the kind of thing that you find out, you know, and you could find out in America, you never would have found out had my family stayed in China, right? But my brother was, you know, my parents were basically looking for something to do with this kid who was very, very athletic and kind of wild, they thought. And they signed him up at the Hillcrest Lakers Boys Club, where they rotated them around. You know, the coach somehow found out that my brother could really throw. And, you know, so much so that he was introduced to Tom Seaver. Tom Seaver taught him the curveball. And he was in the papers. And also, I will say, my brother had kind of this classic American childhood, including scenes that, of course, inspired some of the scenes in my book. That I can remember him out back, you know, with a target set up, and there he is throwing and throwing and throwing till he could hit those corners, and he could hit those corners. He also had the great classic American childhood of like playing in the streets, you know, so he's playing in the streets, and you know, he's got, you know, they're hitting all those foul balls into the neighbor's yard. Neighbor comes out, takes their Spalding ball, puts it on the driveway, and says, you hit one more ball into my yard, and this is what's going to happen to it. She takes his cleaver. But, you know, all that stuff is part of, you know, was part of what we grow up. And I think, so when I say, you know, when I have this association of baseball and Americanness, you know, it's not just, you know, like I've read in a paper someplace that, you know, baseball is the American pastime. Like, I really get it, that, you know, baseball has a special place, you know, in the American psyche, and in the immigrant psyche, that made it a very natural foil to this, you know, to this dystopia. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, so this, you know, because as a fiction writer, you know this, you know, there's a moment which, you know, there's something you realize you want to write about. But then there's also a moment where you say, well, where's my drama? Like, what's at stake, you know? And when someone's looking around for that, well, what is it? You know, what is it that actually, you know, what's the stand-in for our humanity? What's you know, what would we lose if we continue on the path that we're on? You know, how do we? You know, how can you make our humanity visceral and real? And I thought, baseball.
But at that point, did you want to write the dystopian novel first, or did you? I mean,
how
did
the dystopian novel came first?
Okay, you wanted to write the dystopia, right?
Well, because as I was sort of saying, it's 2017, and you know, I mean, I kind of, you know, and all these things, like as my daughter is going out into this world, you know, I am simultaneously very hopeful. Because, I mean, I'm looking at all these incredible young people. They're so engaged. They're so aware. They're so smart. They're so, you know, they're so much better educated than I was at that age, for sure. Mature beyond their years. So I'm full of hope, but I'm also quite worried, right? And so, you know, so I think that, you know, so this book really grows out of that those twin feelings. And neither of which has anything to do with baseball, right? So they really grow out of, you know, Aunt Nettie, like what I'm looking at. I was going to say another thing that happened in 2017 was that the Facebook had chatbots. Do you remember this? The chatbots started to talk to each other, and they developed a language which was non-human. So nobody knew what they were saying. And Facebook, they were so freaked out that Facebook shut that experiment down because... you know what I mean? It's like, oh my God, they're talking to each other. We don't understand what they're saying. It was terrifying. And it precipitated a very, very heated back and forth between Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk, you know, about AI. And of course, as we know, you know, a lot of the fears about AI, are unfortunately have proven to be true. Right. And I actually saw somebody, one of my grade school friends is a very brilliant woman who was on the team right in there with Al Gore to develop the internet. And she, you know, I just saw her in Washington, and I said to her, and she's still kind of, she's very interested in privacy. And I said to her, I said, so, you know, is my book alarmist? You know, you're like, what do you think? You know, and she said, it's a lot worse than people realize. Yeah. And she's working on the technological end. So what can be done technologically to protect us? And she said basically what I would say too is that, you know, we need legislation.
Well, the dystopian not, the book,
you know, but
is...
But anyway, but, you know, so the business about Aunt Nettie, and unfortunately, it's all true. Yes, you may get a word in edgewise.
Right. The dystopia in the book, if you read it, is actually seems about 1 degree removed from the contemporary moment, because many of the features of the dystopia that you describe are also features of what we have today. So, for example... the idea that there will be a surplus population, that there will be no place for this surplus population. They have no jobs left. They've been automated out of existence.
Yep.
Their only function is to remain as consumers, to consume the products that this automated society produces.
And they have a universal basic income.
Universal basic income.
I wrote that before Andrew Yang.
Right. But getting to that moment, and the moment that you describe, is definitely dystopian. People are not happy, terrible things happen and all that. But is it safe, is it fair to describe the book's mood as comic and optimistic?
Yeah, you know, people have sort of said it's kind of a buoyant dystopia. You know? I know that. But, you know, you've got to say that, but that's something I will say, this business of a kind of a mixed tone, that's something which people have been talking about in my work since graduate school. You know, and I will say that, you know, we both come from the world of yin and yang, you know, so I do think that there is a way in which I was always comfortable with the idea of opposites in the same work. But when I was in graduate school, it was always, is this happy or is this sad? And I would say, well, it's happy and it's sad. And they will say, well, but is it happy or is it sad? I mean, but, you know, and I, you know, it took me some time to realize that was just me. And that, yeah, like I say, that, you know, a lot of it is that, you know, we have our roots in the world of yin-yang, you know. And not only do I not want to reconcile the tone, I would feel that something was incomplete without the other. Do you mean, like, for me, that's an aesthetic good. And, you know, I would feel uncomfortable somehow without it. But like you see it in typical American, and you see it here, and that's like when some people say, but when it sounds so funny, a buoyant dystopia. But I think that's how you know it's a Gish Gen novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Well, branded, a branded experience here. there's a lot of branding that's going on in the book, various kinds of things. So Gish Jen would be one of these things that the novel could feature. I mean, last question before we get to questions from the audience is an authorial question. Of course, as a writer, I'm interested in the kinds of choices that authors make. And in this novel, you've chosen to tell the novel from a particular character's perspective, Grant, the father of this family, of whom Gwen, his daughter, is the picture on which this whole plot is based, her terrific arm and how she's going to go to the Olympics or not go to the Olympics, as the case might be. Why tell the story from Grant's perspective versus from Gwen's perspective, since Gwen is the hero or heroine of the novel? Because it shapes the novel in very fundamental right. ways.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you think about it, you know, what could be more, well, my first problem, if you're going to have a pitching prodigy, and actually I have not just a pitching prodigy, I also have, you know, a tremendously ferocious, you know, larger-than-life lawyer. So I have two larger-than-life characters. And if you think about it, just, you know, like, well, how would you do that? You've got to have the witness, right? In other words, this, and nothing is, and also nothing is more off-putting than sort of saying, you know, I think I'm really something as a pitcher. You know, in fact, I think someday I may be the greatest pitcher in America. I mean, what could be worse, right? Now, you know, you need a witness. In the same way, and also, you need a witness. Also, just you need somebody in this book who's like an ordinary mortal. And I will say that once I realized that I had two larger-than-life things, I mean, so you could either have the mother supporting her larger-than-life lawyer and her larger-than-life son, or you can have a father, you know, supporting his larger-than-life daughter and his larger-than-life wife. And you may guess which one was more appealing to me. So that's, so that's part of it. But like I say, you need the witness. You need the witness who was kind of small. The same way, if you wanted to make a statue look really large, you know, you want to be looking up at it, you know. Or the same way that Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby,
that was what occurred,
you know what I mean? We would not believe, you know, in order to have this legendary Gatsby-like figure, you need to see it through the lens of Nick Carraway, right? Because that's how you get the feeling like, whoa, you know, this guy is really something. So that's why. So I needed that point of view.
Great. And so it's a really crucial decision that all writers have to make. So now we have time for questions, and we're going to do something a little different than the usual LA allowed events. I like to get into the audience and, field the questions myself. But the questions are not for me. They're for Gish, right? But if you have a question, please raise your hand, and I will try to get there as fast as I can.
This is wonderful talk. Such good sense of humor. You are ABC.
Yes.
So you became super American, not just American.
What? I am a
super American, big baseball and everything. You wrote another book prior to this about the girl waiting at the line.
I'm sorry?
A girl waiting at the baggage line? Baggage.
Oh, the girl with the baggage claim. Yeah.
So I'm wondering, short, I don't want to make it long.
What?
You grew up here. Was Chinese your first language? How do you speak Chinese now? Do you write Chinese and speak Chinese?
No. So I was born in America, and English is my first language, and I will say, unfortunately, my only language. I speak a little Chinese. You know, I'm the kind of, I speak the kind of Chinese if I'm in trouble in China, lo and behold, I can get around, you know? But as soon as I get back to America, I forget it all.
Hi, my name is Chris. What does your baseball prodigy brother do now?
Ah, my baseball prodigy brother, actually it was interesting, his baseball was very much associated with our working class situation then. And what happened was that we went from Yonkers, New York, and I mean, really, truly, those kids were so into baseball. It was so organized. It was like the military, basically. And a lot of kids did go into the military. And the coach was from the White Sox and so on. But then we moved to Scarsdale, New York, which is much more upscale. It was much more like, well, you can come. We get out on Saturday if you feel like coming, great. If you don't feel like coming, it's okay. You know, in Yonkers, if you didn't show up for practice, boom, you're dropped. But he's gone on to be very athletic. And he is now, he went on to be a star marathoner. He ran for Nike. And then he went on to be a mountain climber. He was the first Asian American up Mount Everest, and also he did go up. He's the kind of guy who gets up there and when you know things are really rough and there's a storm, and he's the kind of guy who will stay in his tent bivouac for 3 weeks by himself when everybody else has come down. My brother's the one. He's also, I will say, he's rescued a lot of people and brought a lot of people down off of very dangerous mountains.
Why didn't you just write a book about him?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I have to say, it's hard to believe that we're related. I mean, whenever he does something like that, you know, he's just rescued somebody off some Nepali something. I always think I can definitely do 45 minutes on the elliptical.
Maybe a last. Do we have time for one more question, or how many questions? Just one, two more questions. Okay.
Thanks. So you were talking about kind of the change in literary workshops and seeing more programs, and hopefully the diversification of those programs. Callie Fajardo-Anstein and Lisa Lucas were here for Aloud last week, and they were talking about that they believe that there's been a change in kind of the literary award world, where they're seeing more kind of diversification there, but that publishing hasn't quite caught up yet. And I was curious, both of you, if you kind of agree or disagree with that take.
You know, I would say that you're absolutely right. I mean, it's very hard to change the institutions. And one of the problems is simply that, you know, the salaries are so low. I mean, honestly, I think that they're trying very, very, very hard. But it's just a little bit like, you know, the challenge is why people like Viet and I don't become writers. I mean, by the time they get the kids through this, you know, through the colleges, it's not just the parents. I mean, the kids have also internalized this idea that, like, maybe I should go and try to make a living. And I think that, you know, people in publishing are not rich, you know, the idea that they all have trust funds, I mean, that's not right. But a lot of them are in a position where they know that they'll inherit a little bit when their parents die. And the difference between inheriting a little bit, meaning, you know, you're not going to be going into your old age with nothing, and inheriting nothing is actually huge. And so I think that what happens is a lot of people, you know, they're from marginalized backgrounds, And very understandably, they don't want to be in that position. I mean, really, truly, the salaries are just so low. So it's tough, you know. But like I say, I think that, I know firsthand, publishing, they're trying very, very, very hard. But it's difficult with the economics of the situation being what they are.
Well, speaking about the economics as they are and awards, in 1987, you won an award from Nimrod Magazine for a short story called The Water Faucet Vision, which is still my favorite short story in the whole world. And it's very funny. And I wondered if you could speak to what Little Magazines and that award meant for you.
Oh, my God, it was huge. It was huge. So you're right. I did not win first prize, and that was the Catherine M. Porter Prize. And I won second prize. But it didn't mean that I was flown to Oklahoma City. And it was the first time I'd ever been flown anywhere for my work. And what? And I missed the plane. You remember. Are you Fran? I don't have my distance glasses on. I think that's Fran. So you were the editor of Nimrod Magazine then, and it's wonderful to see you again.
Like I said, I just want to say you rejected me, by the way. Okay, sorry, no, go. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead. You know.
But you know, but it is really true that these little awards, you know, those first. And by the way, I'm still friends with Emily, whose last name has just escaped me. You know, but after all these, Stephen Schwartz, who were there at that thing, you know, they make a huge difference. And it's, you know, I have been incredibly lucky that way. You know, it's like one little award, and then some awards that weren't so little. And you know, it's just, you know, every writer. Maybe not you. You know, there's a lot of self-doubt, and there, you know, it's kind of like you may have some voice in you that says that you just have to do this, but you know, every other voice in your life says this is folly, and you know, you are headed for ruin. You know, this is the worst thing that, you know, worst decision of your life. You cannot do this. You are not going to succeed. You know, every single thing. You know, every voice. You know, even now. voices say you don't have another novel in you. You know, I mean, in other words, the voices of self-doubt, you know, are just everywhere. And to get, you know, to get a little prize and to go up and, you know, and to stand at a mic and have people actually want to hear your story is transformative. It's transformative. Even though, yeah, and then I did actually also learn to take a plane then, I think. I actually missed my plane in both directions. Oklahoma City. It's funny. I missed my plane on the way out, and on the way back in, I thought, okay, I missed that plane. I've got to get there really early, and I sat there, and unfortunately, a friend of mine in Oklahoma City had given me his manuscript, and I said it was really good. But anyway, so I'm sitting there. The plane is like right there, and I'm reading, and I look up. I go to the stewardess. I say, what happened to my plane? My plane. She was like, it was here. You didn't hear. Anyway, my friend, however, was very flattered and happy. Very rightly so.
I'm just kidding about the rejection, by the way. I was rejected by your magazine, but I actually don't take it personally. I've been rejected by dozens and dozens of periodicals. And speaking of short stories,
and sometimes with good reason.
Yeah, and sometimes with good reason. But I mean, just one last thing I want to say about short stories. You know, you're talking about self-doubt, frustration, all this kind of stuff. I mean, I wrote a book called The Refugees, a collection of short stories. It took me literally 20 years from beginning to publication on that book. Whereas you stepped in with your collection, Who's Irish, and like, oh, you know, published two stories in the Best American Short Stories, and then John Updike picked one for the Best American Short Stories of the century. So
it's not so
you're doing
easy.
Great. You're doing great. Yeah, no, it is. I mean, but you make it look easy, which is the way it should look. Anyway, the last note I want to end on is, of course, we're all here to support the Los Angeles Public Library as well. They do something called the stay-at-home ball. I believe that's official. Stay-at-home and read a book ball. So it demands very little of you. It takes place on March 1st.
You don't have to dress up.
You don't. I mean, that's actually the whole point. You can stay home and wear whatever it is that you normally wear. On March 1st, I will be reading a book called Minor Feelings, by Kathy Park Hong. She's a poet.
A cool book.
It's a cool book. It's a fantastic. So I mean, I've read most of it. It's a fantastic book.
I have read all of it.
You have read all of it?
Yeah.
No, I had to say that I wouldn't read most. I still have to read it by March 1st. But it's a fantastic book of essays on race in America, but also the Asian American condition or conditions in particular. Kathy Park Hong really burns it down in this book. Will you be reading a book?
Yes, I will be reading a book.
Yes. Can you tell us what it is?
Yeah, I'll be reading Julia Alvarez's new book, Afterlife. And this is a fantastic book, I have to say. I mean, I guess I'll be rereading it. Truth of the matter is I have already read it. I think it's coming out in April. But this is a wonderful book about a retired Latina English professor who thinks that she's done with life only to have this pregnant, undocumented lady just end up in her living room. And so there she is, forced to be reborn. It's very, very wonderful, very beautiful. The last, a very important line in it is beautiful. And truly, this book is beautiful.
So we hope you'll join us in reading a book for this great cause. Pick up an invitation in the lobby or ask someone how you can RSVP. Gish will be signing books in the lobby. Let's give her a hand.
Thank you, Viet.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.